Hey, good morning and welcome to the December 19th meeting of 2016 of Chelan County Board of Commissioners. So this is our last scheduled meeting for the year. And it's been a great year for the organization and a lot of good work. And we're positioned well and much appreciation to everyone who has made the effort for that to happen. Related to our cell phones, if they could be in a position that wouldn't interfere with the meeting, I'd appreciate that. And if you have the opportunity to address the commission this morning, please do so by utilizing the microphone that's available, and please state your name and address because our meetings are recorded. We have two commissioners in view and a third commissioner on the line. Commissioner Cogdon, I understand you're there.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. That constitutes a quorum for us. So there's nothing else to add at this point. Off we go. And TJ Farrell, please. Safety minute and flag salute.
To the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, and how is everyone?
Good.
Happy holidays. Safety minute, very pertinent with the weather we're having outside today. I'd like to talk to you just briefly about frostbite and hypothermia, how to spot it, what to do. Frostbite is actually the freezing of skin and tissues and can cause permanent damage to the body. It can even lead to amputation if not treated properly or soon enough. It's increased with people with reduced blood circulation and among people who are not properly dressed for extreme cold temperatures. And the symptoms are the development of gray or white patches on exposed skin, particularly fingers, toes, nose, earlobes, tingling and aching, loss of feeling, firm or hard flesh, and blisters. First aid is to follow recommendations described for hypothermia, which I will get to in just a minute, but mostly remember to protect the frostbitten area, wrap it in a loose, dry cloth, and do not rub it, do not break the blisters, do not apply snow or water to it. Don't try to rewarm it unless you're in a place where the rewarming can be a permanent thing, because if it rewarms and then refreezes, it'll cause even more damage. And support the person with some warm, sweetened drinks if they are alert, but not alcohol. And then also talking about hypothermia, because you want to treat the person similarly. Hypothermia is losing your actual core temperature, your normal body temperature, dropping below 95 degrees Fahrenheit. That'll come, again, from exposure to cold temperatures and causing your body to lose heat faster than you can replace it. Prolonged exposure will use up your energy, and your low body temperature will result. It can even occur at cool temperatures that are around or above 40 degrees Fahrenheit if you're not properly dressed for it and exposed for too long. And this can be speeded up through rain or perspiration or immersion in cold water. So a person with hypothermia may be uncontrollably shivering. They may actually have also gone beyond the point where they can shiver. So it just because they're no longer shivering, that's not a good sign. They can have loss of coordination, confusion, slurred speech, irregular heart or slow heart rate and breathing, unconsciousness, can lead to death. And low body temperature can affect the brain, making them unable to think clearly. So it's a hard thing to spot in yourself. But if you find that you're cold and confused, it's time to get help. So first aid, call 911 in an emergency. Move that person to a warm, dry area if you possibly can. Remove any wet clothing from them and replace it with dry clothing or blankets. Wrap their whole body, including their head and neck, because you want to try to preserve all that heat from escaping that they are able to recreate. Don't cover their face. If medical help is more than 30 minutes away, give them warm, sweetened drinks if you can. No alcohol again. And place some warm bottles or hot packs around them on their armpits, sides of the chest, on their legs. Get that body temperature back up again. But treat it seriously, because it's one of the things that we do face here in the Northwest. And hopefully everybody is staying warm and dry and happy for the holidays.
Well, a lot of that has to do with this organization staying warm and dry.
So exactly. Much appreciated. And functioning, yes.
Yeah. Well, and TJ, I think it's kind of interesting when I look at some of our safety presentations. This summer, we were dealing with heat and heat exhaustion. And then in the winter, which is also states very clearly, mm-hmm. the 110-degree shift that we can experience in this community. And
no kidding.
In our temperatures, but how many of the symptoms between heat exhaustion and hypothermia are very, very similar?
They're a bit similar, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you and well done. Any questions or thoughts or comments?
All right.
Thank you
for your time.
Good morning.
Thank you, TJ.
And one of the things I neglected to do is that this is a different voice for those of you who are listening at the microphone. I am Dennis Bowles, and have the honor of chairing the meeting today due to the hierarchy of organization. And I have a post of secretary. Gary Arsenault is with me, and Ann Congdon on the phone. Commissioners, let's take a look at item two, please, the approval of the agenda. Your thoughts, please.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve the agenda as presented.
Okay, there has been some thoughts about moving resolutions 9 and 10 to the consent agenda with lessons learned, I believe, on item 10 to remain.
Yes, we could present the lessons learned. If you move that to the consent agenda, we could present that lesson learned after you've approved the resolution.
Okay. Having that information, commissioners, do we want to stay with the agenda as it is, or would you like to amend it?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move items number 9 and 10 to the consent agenda and then approve the agenda as adjusted.
Okay. Your thoughts, Commissioner Congdon? Commissioner Congdon, do you have an opinion? Have we lost you? I think we're one. Commissioner?
Yes. Are you asking for Ann?
Yeah, I am. Ann,
I'm here.
We're taking a look at moving 9 and 10 to the consent agenda with the lessons learned remaining on item 10. Any thoughts along that line?
No, that sounds fine to me. No objection.
Okay. So it does not take a formal action of the board to do so. So we will move items 9 and 10 to the consent agenda. And also regarding, well, we'll deal with the consent agenda this afternoon when we get there. Any other thoughts at this point?
None for me.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Dennis.
Okay. Yeah, so now is the appropriate time. Okay. Also, on the consent agenda is minutes from the special meeting of December 12th and the Tri-Commission meeting December 13th. It's been recommended that we pull these because they are not out in the hands of the commissioners and no one has seen them. So it would probably be best to place those on our meeting agenda for the first regular meeting in January. Any thoughts or objections?
I think that makes a great deal of sense, and I would move that we do so.
All right. Thank you. So noted, and we'll move on then. General Manager Steve Wright, our fiber loop rates.
I want to ask Mike Coleman to come up and join us with our consultant, Doug Dawson, to talk about. This will be the second time we've gone through a discussion about broadband rate design, specifically on the fiber loop rate. So turn that over to Mike for an update. It's been close to a couple months since we discussed this last time.
It has been. Good morning, Commissioners. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecommunications. And with me is Doug Dawson, who is the principal of CCG Consulting and somebody that we've used for a number of years on our fiber and telecommunications program. Today, we're going to talk about the transition from service-based rates to loop rates on our broadband network, and there's no action required today. And in the presentation today, we're not only going to address the loop rates, which is the final item from our 2012 Fiber Strategic Plan. We're going to talk about how it encourages service providers to offer low-cost packages for light users, and it allows the revenue management as bandwidth growth changes. We're also going to discuss the other rate changes, new services, service enhancements, and market adjustments. Our philosophy has been consistent. This is virtually the same slide that we looked at back in September. Our intent was to simplify the rates and align cost with the drivers by charging based on a measured usage component. We want to provide that incentive to the service providers to reach more homes and businesses than they do today, and to support our revenue at current levels and then grow that revenue as usage requires additional investment to the network. And I'll let Doug.
All right. Good morning. I want to talk a bit about the internet, and then we're going to talk about the specific rate designs. Interestingly, bandwidth nationwide and worldwide is growing at an unbelievable pace. What this slide says is it took 26 years from the very beginning of the internet to get up what is called a zettabit of data, which the next slide I'll show you what that is, but that's a gigantic amount of data. That's all the traffic that is in the world today for all of the internet in every country. So it took 26 years to get there. Cisco, who was the leading tracker of that statistic, says in 3 years we will double that. So 3 years from now, worldwide, there will be twice as much data as the whole planet uses today. So the growth curve is gigantic, and that growth comes from two things. It comes from a little bit from new users. Last year, the planet added 1 billion new people to the internet. That's just a mind-boggling number. But most of them are on cell phones, and so they're not using the same kind of data that somebody on a fiber connection is using, but still they're starting to use data. And so the whole planet is still growing. There's still 3.5 to 4 billion people who don't have any access to the internet. They will be coming on. But most of that growth just comes from all of us using more data. I mean, every single household around and every business is using more data at that same tremendous rate. So when you see that traffic's going to double in 3 years, about a fourth of that comes from new people. The other three quarters of that just comes from us using more data. And so that's going to, and that talks about the strain that's going to have on your fiber network. Even though your fiber network is the best technology out there, it's going to keep getting used harder and harder and harder. So Cisco also predicts that in the U.S. that by 2020 that 82% of the traffic will be from video. I mean, that's what's using the internet. It used to be other stuff, but everyone's watching everything there is on the internet now, and that trend is growing faster and faster. I mean, it's just everyone is moving to Netflix and everything else. So that is driving it, and there's a lot of other things coming in the future that are going to drive it. We're not very many years away from seeing the very first version of almost, you want to call it, the holodeck, where we're going to have 3D projections in your living room gaming. That'll be the gamers at first, but pretty soon after that, that'll be your kids talking to their grandmother on Christmas Day. I mean, we're not very far away from that. Literally less than 5 years, you'll have that in your living room. So that's also video. I mean, that's just personal video. So the needs for bandwidth are just becoming a little bit mind-boggling, honestly. If any of you are my age and remember being on a dial-up modem, this is kind of amazing.
I do remember. There's a certain amount of scar tissue that goes with that.
It's like, yes, I want to see this picture. 10 minutes later, you see the picture. So what is a zettabit? You can see 1,000 megabits is 1 gigabit, and that's an important number because we're going to talk a minute about how much you're going to charge for selling a gigabit of data to your customers. So, you know, a gigabit is a ton of data. That's a very high resolution video for about an hour as a gigabit. So, and there's a lot of pixels in a high resolution video. So one gigabit is the beginning of the curve. You go at times 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000 times 1,000, which, you know, gets you those other numbers that nobody really can get their hands around. I can say, well, that's 1,000, you know, petabits, but you can't get your mind around a petabit because we're talking the whole world here. So, you know, that many times thousands times, you know, times a movie. So it's just an amazing giant pile of usage, and that's going to double in the next 3 years. So, and that curve's not going to slow down. It's going to keep doing that. So it's just a mind-boggling large amount of data. And so and talking about, in the next slide, and talking about moving your network to a structure that is partially loop-based, which we'll talk about in a minute, and partially data-based. Luckily, your folks here have been tracking the data on their on your network for many years, and so you have an idea of what the growth rate is. But and so this chart shows you what happens if it grows. The red curve is sort of the expected growth, which is at what 36% a year. That gets you the tripling in 3 years. Then that's what happens if it's 10% faster or 10% slower than that. In any case, you know, your network is going to have that much more on it. Again, you're going to add new customers, but mostly that's going to come from your current customers using more bandwidth. And so the rate design has been set upon this growth curve. And if you remember when I talked to you, I think it was 3 or 4 months ago, we were trying to find a mechanism that would handle that sort of potential plus or minus 10%. And the structure we have now today handles that. So that's what we want to talk to you a bit about. So then to talk about the actual rate design, it comes in two pieces. There will be a fixed loop rate and there will be a bandwidth rate. The fixed loop rate is a concept that's been around the telecom industry. It's been around actually for 30 or 40 years, but it really became a large topic of conversation in 1996 when the FCC and actually Congress and the Telecommunications Act of 1996 forced the telephone companies to sell loops. And so all the AT&T and Verizon and everybody else had to sell loops to folks, meaning that competitive providers could come in, third parties, and they could get an access directly to a customer. And that's essentially what you're selling. You own the network, but you have the ISPs on your network come to you and buy a connection between them and your customer, and that connection is 100% there. So that concept of an end-to-end wired connection to go to each customer has been called a loop. It's something that's just been around forever. We want to recognize that in the rate design to say there's a basic cost just for getting there. It's just the physical fixed cost of the fiber between here and there, and we want to recover that on a fixed basis because the cost is the same to every customer. If they use the network or don't use the network, they have a loop. And so that first half of the rate design is to recover for that loop cost. And then the rest of the rates, and here we're not talking all the rate designs, we're talking about the basic connections to residences and businesses. So. Not the big, large business rates. The rest of that cost recovery then will be on a bandwidth rate. And so we will start charging the ISPs by the gigabit. And so back to that last chart, that's 1 gigabit, about half of an HD movie. And so so to talk about the actual rate design, here's a sample. For a customer who has 100 megabits down and a 10 megabit up connection, we would charge $12. For the actual loop, so every month the ISP would pay $12 just to have that connection to the customer, and then the rest of the usage would be billed on a loop rate, and that earlier chart of the high and the low would set that rate somewhere between 5 and 10 cents per gigabit, with the rate most likely being right in the middle there somewhere. In fact, Mike will be coming back to you in I think January 3rd or 6th with an actual rate there. To put that in perspective, that, you know, we're talking, let's say that it's at the high end of that range, 10 cents per gigabit. When all of you have cell phone plans and Verizon and AT&T charge you $10 for a gigabit, this is 10 cents. So they're charging 100 times more for a gigabit than what you're going to be charging the ISPs. That's a mind-boggling difference of numbers, which speak not only to how good of a rate this is, it also tells you how bad of a rate theirs is. The cell phone data in this country is the most expensive bandwidth in the whole planet. No one else pays that much for bandwidth. So that allows an ISP then to pay $12 guaranteed access to a customer, and then they're going to pay after that for the gigabits they use. The same way for a 1 gigabit product, which you also sell, customers can get a 1 gigabit connection. And then they'll pay $36 for the loop, and then the same gigabit rate. That structure meets all of the goals that Mike laid out on the earlier slide. Over time, what's going to happen, just go back to the slide that showed the very steep curve for the growth of the rates, your costs are not on that same curve. Your costs are increasing a couple percent a year with inflation. And so what that will do is we're going to have more and more bandwidth recovering just barely more revenue every year. And so that gigabit rate's going to drop like a rock. If it starts at 6 or 7 cents a day, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years from now, it'll be a penny. So the gigabit rate's going to get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, which makes it easier and easier and easier over time to find some products that will satisfy people who can't afford the big expensive products. And so that's the long-term goal of this, is that you could have a customer who, you know, I always use my mother as a great example. She only does email. If my mother used a gigabit, that would be an amazing month. So she does not watch Netflix, and so she has her DVD player. So
I think something that I would add to that explanation, just for clarity, is that since we're a layer two network, we are not looking at individual customers' usage. We are only measuring the ISP's aggregated bandwidth. This, in effect, makes the ISPs manage their customers. And so it's an incentive to the ISPs to not only manage their customers, but manage how they're selling and marketing to those customers. And it gives them the responsibility for analyzing their customers' usage pattern and what kind of rate packages they would like to develop to meet their needs. While still giving them that additional flexibility for the low-end users, the light users, or the folks that just simply cannot afford a full-blown fiber-to-the-home rate package, to give them something that allows very reasonable bandwidth at a very, very low competitive cost.
Well, and to put that in perspective, right now, the latest measurements, the ISP customers, again, you don't look at individual customers, you look at the pile. They're using about 175 gigabits a month, but that includes some businesses. So the average residence is probably using somewhere between 125 and 150 gigabits a month. My mother is in that pile, and so are the people who use a terabit. But on average, then that, under this rate structure, is going to cost, you know, in the range of, you know, $12 or $15 or $17, depending on where their rate comes in, for all the gigabit usage for all those customers. But the low customers, my mother, if an ISP wanted to offer her a package, they would pay $12 for the loop, and they would pay another nickel or dime for her internet usage, and that's all that they would pay you. You can structure a very profitable product with that as your cost basis. So it allows the ISPs to have that flexibility to start saying, I will have different packages for different customers. They can all be profitable. And so it's a very interesting way to look at it. There's really no one else around the country looking at it this way, but with the way bandwidth is going, this makes perfect sense. I bet if you go back, well, I know for a fact I've seen it, if you go back to the original reason you bought the network, you want everyone in the county to have access to the internet. I mean, that was one of the major social reasons for building this network. This finally allows products to be developed that gets that bottom third of the market who are having trouble paying the bills. They're paying the bills for 175 gigabits when they're not using 175 gigabits. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. So
this does make a tremendous amount of sense and levels the cost structure to the ISP.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And if I'm reading you, then you would anticipate the ISPs to respond in a manner that takes this new cost structure into account and develop packages that would provide high band usage users a fee based on that amount of usage, and then the lower cost providers for those that have very small usage demands at a lower fee. That's exactly what you're saying.
Well, and in my past, I'm not just a consultant. I've owned a whole bunch of ISPs. That's what I would do. I mean, that, you know, if every product you sell makes money, that's never a bad thing.
Precisely. No, that's a great business model.
I like profit. That one.
I personally like that model.
That's a good model.
It is a good model. Yeah. So anyhow, then the actual rate methodology is very straightforward. Over time, it's really hard to predict usage. And so you don't really know how fast it's going to grow next year. Is it going to grow 20%, 25%, 30%? And so what Mike and his group have come up with is a structure that sort of, as I talked to you last time, we will normalize those rates for a while. So for this first year, the rates will be set in such a way that the ISPs are guaranteed not to pay anymore. But they're still going to be paying that gigabit rate. It's just that we're going to smooth that out with the billing method that that sort of takes the risk out of it, with the goal over time, over the next few years after that, that you will, and as that rate gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, it starts looking like a penny a gigabit, that you'll probably introduce that variability a lot more, because that's a whole lot less painful. Even, you know, a penny is a 20% of a nickel. So when that rate starts getting really cheap, then the variability becomes less of an issue. So, and so the goal is to start this concept, because we're going to start publishing that rate. That's what's going to induce those low price products, but also take out the variability through some very clever billing that sort of says we're going to a billing rate, but we're going to make sure that you don't pay a big penalty this year in case we're guessing the amount of usage wrong. But over time, that usage will probably become a lot clearer. I think you'll probably get to it. It's not plus or minus 10%. I'm going to guess you're going to get to where it's plus or minus a couple percent. The reason it's so hard to guess right now is you just came off of a major network upgrade. You moved from BPON to GPON, and when you did that, a lot of houses were finding blockages in the evening, and when they no longer had those blockages, they started using more bandwidth, and so they're starting to get where they actually are using what they want to use, and so now you're sort of reestablishing the curve with a brand new network, essentially, and so now that you're when you're on that curve for a while, I think you understand the growth rate. So. But you know, we're going to the system. Your proposal is to go to that sort of billing system, do it in such a way that doesn't penalize the ISPs for the first year or so, but eventually get to a much more variable rate structure.
So want of a better term, more of an annualized.
I'm sorry?
Want of a better term, more of an annualized structure.
Correct, and I'm going to get into that detail in just a moment. I guess what I would add to what Doug said there, we have worked with ISPs on our predictions for the bandwidth growth. Our prediction is very, very consistent, particularly with the dominant provider. It also is consistent with what Douglas County and Grant County are seeing on their networks. Last two bullet points here in setting this, and particularly for this first year, we wanted a range that was capable of handling unexpected variation. So a rate range of 5 cents a gigabyte up to 10.5 cents a gigabyte actually tolerates an annual bandwidth growth from a negative 13% all the way up to 83%. Again, that expectation is 36% annual growth rate. And as Doug said, it does continue for now to provide that bill stability to the service providers. To get into the details, we have our prediction on the bandwidth growth. We also have calculated the revenue that's required from that bandwidth in order to maintain overall revenue neutrality from our core services. That bandwidth is going to be forecasted quarterly and billed on an average monthly rate. That's part of the normalization. As we see a change in the bandwidth growth rate, what we see as actuals will be different than the prediction, the forecast. We will adjust that, excuse me, we will adjust that quarterly to capture the variation from the forecast, and then a new aggregated bandwidth rate will be produced each quarter. That will also produce the target bandwidth revenue, which is calculated quarterly, all of it based on the updated forecast. So as part of this methodology, the rates will change through time in order to maintain the revenue neutrality. If we see extraordinary growth, it may require a speeded up investment in the broadband network. And if that's the case and it starts getting outside that range of minus 13 to plus 83% growth, we would be coming back to you, the commission, for a rate increase to accommodate that. We also have a lot of other rates that are going to change. Some of our other services, we're making some technology updates to our virtual local area network services. We're adding the Metro Ethernet Forum standards to it. We're also lowering the VLAN rates to better achieve a competitive posture in the marketplace. We did surveys, we did look at what other competitors are offering the same or similar services for in the market area. We are taking a 10% increase on dark fiber rates to move them more towards what the true market value of that service is. In addition, we're going to be introducing new fiber services, wave division multiplexing, which is also known as Lambda services. That will be a price competitive alternative to dark fiber. The benefit to the district is you can put 4, 8, or 28 circuits on a single fiber rather than tying up an individual fiber for each one of the service providers that's looking for a circuit in that route. We're also adding a one-time non-recurring charge for provisioning the quality of service for IPTV and voice over internet protocol. Our network has always been best effort, and to offer the IPTV and a higher quality voice over IP, QoS has to be implemented. So we are recovering the cost on a one-time basis for each service provider to implement the QoS that they specify. Along with that, we're introducing a new rate for IPTV so that we not only will have the conventional RF over fiber offering TV channels, but also IPTV channels. On the plain old telephone service, we're reducing the rates. We have changed the way that we provision that, and it lowers our requirement for both operations and hardware, and that's reflected in the rate going down. And the last change is really a minor change, but we're including the non-recurring fees and charges schedule with the rate schedule for clarity. That's always been traditional in the telecom world, so that when somebody looks at the rate, they see right beside the rate what the non-recurring charges and any other fees and charges that are applicable to that service. It just simply prevents confusion. So
in summary, I guess, you know, again, I recommended going to loop rates back in 2012, for I think the first time I met with the board here, and that was through a very large project we did to just look at how fiber should move forward in the future. And so this is, as he said, this is the last item on that agenda. I like clients like you because you actually did everything that I recommended. That never happened. but you know, and the business is in much more solid position today. Mike has done a tremendous job, and his folks, and the you know, it, financially, the business is much more sound than it was back when I first came here. Again, this encourages the service providers to take a new look at how they serve customers, and hopefully, over in time, this induces them to come out with some new products. And so, you know, that's the number one biggest benefit of this is that loop rate, it's that bandwidth rate gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. That should be easier and easier to help everyone in the community get on the fiber network. It also allows, because you're looking at the ISPs as a whole, it also allows much better management of bandwidth because you've now tied that bandwidth rate to your bandwidth cost, so that if that really gets out of control, you can adjust that rate to sort of recover having to beef up the network. So. The other rate charges, I'm supporting all those. Those are all part of what a rate rebalancing is, and it's very healthy every 3 or 4 years to look at all those rates because the other rates are very much market driven. This particular loop rates are much closer to cost driven because you have to recover your costs. But the other rates, the goal is to change them so that you can sell more of them. And so I think all of those changes are intended to do that, and I think those are very, very good changes. So you know, there's. I guess you'll be seeing all of this stuff in the next meeting, right? So.
That takes us to the next steps. On January 3rd, I plan on being back and presenting a draft resolution, which will contain the complete rate tables. We will give that to you on January 3rd. We'll be back on January the 16th to ask for action on that resolution. And then if approved, the rates, fees, and charges will be effective March 1st. Any questions?
I'd just like to say that I'm particularly pleased with the concept of moving to a cost-based rate recovery fee structure. that will help the fiber program here at the district cover its costs of operation. Mm-hmm. To me, that just makes sense. It's a very good business model. There's a second piece of this that I'm very pleased with, and that is I've done a significant amount of work through my Rotary Club in terms of outreach within our community and doing things like lunch buddy programs and working with the school districts. And today's student is tasked with researching tremendous amounts of data in order to address questions in the classroom. And here we live in a county that has a very high poverty level rate, and a significant number of students are disadvantaged right off the start. Is that they don't have internet at home because the basic program requires terabytes of information and the family just can't afford it. So that was why I was asking the question earlier about will the ISPs adopt a new structure, fee structure, that will lower the cost of access to the internet for these students who now have the ability to do their homework at home and research the internet, puts their education on a par basis with other students that do have internet currently. So I'm excited by this this business model that we're moving to, and hopefully the ISPs will also embrace the lower cost of providing internet service to families in packages that are affordable. So I'm very pleased to hear us moving in this direction.
We're trying to provide them all the incentive possible to do that. There are also external incentives. The FCC has a program where they now provide broadband services under the Lifeline program, and specifically they will remit to the service provider $10 a month towards a broadband package, and they do have some very, very good terms on those packages, which continue to make them attractive to the end user, but they also make it attractive to the ISP because they're getting $10 of their cost underwritten.
So. Okay. Commissioner Condon, any questions or thoughts?
I don't. Thank you.
Okay. I don't have any at this point. From our community or from the audience, our staff? Mr. Wright.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Doug, always good to see you.
Yes, sir.
And appreciate the work. And Mike, to you and your crew, stem to stern, thank you very much. We're in a position differently, and it's much appreciated. Ratepayers have a great deal in front of them. Different than most any other rural county in America. That's a great spot to be in.
It is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Next up, we want to give you an update. We have spent some time this year just trying to understand better distributed generation and how it affects cost recovery within the district, getting ourselves ready for the potential that is happening in many other parts of the country where distributed generation is becoming a bigger part of the portfolio of resources that utilities are dealing with. Fortunately, because of our low rates, we don't have as big a problem as other people do, but we're trying to learn from others. There is no action required. This is really a background session for you just to give you an idea of what we've learned from that process and how we intend to integrate that into our thoughts about rate making going forward. Lindsay?
Good morning, Commissioners. Lindsay Mons, Business Advisor for Customer Utilities. As Steve mentioned, this was part of our plan for 2016. The district's performance plan was to look at distributed generation, and we were to have it done by year end, and we're just sneaking in under the wire. The last time we were here with the board talking about distributed generation was in 2014, so we'll take a little trip back in time for a moment to remind everyone what it's all about. We'll look at our 2016 efforts and then talk about some future actions or potential future. So what is distributed generation? You know, here at the district, we call it distributed generation or DG. Other utilities call it distributed energy resources or DERS. You hear PV for photovoltaic, distributed power, DP. So those are all talking about fairly similar things And what it is it's a small-scale electric generation installed at or near the point of use. Here at the district, this is a infographic that Jim White prepared in conservation. Kind of gives you an idea of what we see here. On the left, there is a solar panel, and it's connected to an inverter, and that inverter converts the power from a DC to an AC. And then it flows through a snap meter. So, and this keeps track 100% of how much generation is coming through that solar panel. It then moves into the home or the business circuit breaker, where any consumption or use at the premises can use that power in real time. And then if there's any excess power that they're generating beyond their use, it will flow out through the house meter into the PUD's system. If they're not producing enough power for their own home use, then the PUD will deliver power back the other way. And that house meter, the net meter, measures both the delivered and the received power. And on a monthly basis, if the customers elected net metering, that would be billed at the net rate.
Lindsay, I can't help but notice that the CBEX committee paint scheme on our building has been replicated here, and you know Jim White is to be commended for supporting Mr. CBEX in that effort. Yes. Committee. So thank you very much.
I'm sure communications had a hand in.
Well,
I'm sure there
might
were
have.
More than
they
one
might
person
have.
Involved here, but and you know there's an acronym here on this page, SNAP, that Sustainable Natural Alternative Power, and that's a program here at the PUD. So that's our acronym. So when we were here in 2014, we were working on some efforts to provide some guidelines or to help with our external affairs in the legislative process. So we provided, working with the board and some staff focus groups, created a value statement associated with distributed generation, and that was that we support the investment in distributed generation so long as it's safe, reliable, and equitable for our customer owners. And this was paired with a set of guiding principles. And those four things are here, safety, reliability, and performance, so ensuring that those remain equal or better than before adding a distributed resource. Providing for local decision-making, you know, our ability to develop our programs and monitor and control them versus, say, a state-mandated approach. Ensuring fair, equitable allocation of costs and benefits among our customers. And this is both the customers that choose to adopt distributed generation and those that choose not to. So making sure that there aren't shifts amongst those classes. And then finally, consumer protection and customer service. So when these were developed in 2014, there was a lot of talk about third-party service providers. And so consumer protection became a big piece of that. And then ensuring that the district's customer service maintains through all those. So in 2016, our balanced scorecard, one of the tasks was to develop some rate alternatives and to bring them to the board here by Q4. There's a reason this presentation's not called Distributed Generation Rates. Our recommendation through this presentation that I hope to convince you of before the end is that we not undertake a distributed generation specific rate action at this time. So we've done a lot of research and worked with the consultant, and we're headed that way. Let's talk first about our PUD programs. So these are the programs that are currently in place. Two of them are our specific programs, and one is a state program that we administer. The SNAP program was developed in 2001, and it gives customers the option to generate and purchase alternative power resources. This program's managed, a very successful program, I might add, managed the conservation department. Also in 2001, we established net metering, and that was updated in 2006. This is an optional program for customers. But one that we're required under a different law to provide, and that is a retail rate net meter for up to 0.5% of our 1996 peak load. We're about 10% of the way there, so we're not at risk here of hitting any caps. And then finally, the Renewable Energy System Cost Recovery. This is a state program that we administer here at the PUD. Any production incentives that we provide to our customers We then are able to take a tax credit in our public utility tax for the year. And that's up to 0.5% of our revenues. And I think in 2015-2016 reporting year, we paid out about 50% of that available credit and at the rates that the state's established for this program. And those rates, so this is how our owners are compensated. The rates for the Washington State Production Incentive, which is the one I just talked about, the state program, range from 15 cents to 54 cents per kilowatt hour produced. Those vary based on whether their components are made in Washington or in which components those are. Amongst the incentives that we've paid out most recently, our customers average about 41 cents per kilowatt hour. And that's the total production. So when we looked at the schematic of how the PUD systems work, that was the first meter that comes directly off the solar generation. So 100% of their generation is at that 41 cent average. In addition to that, the PUD SNAP program. Through the SNAP program, we collect voluntary contributions from the public or employees, customers, anyone who's interested in supporting our SNAP producers. And we take those total contributions and divide them by the total production for all our SNAP participants. So in the most recent year, that was 6.7 cents per kilowatt hour. When the program first started, it was up over a dollar. So it was pretty amazing. As our the number of SNAP customers grows and their production grows, that dollar amount decrease, or the per kilowatt hour has that's allocated out amongst those has gone down. So, and then finally, whether the customer is elected to be a net metered customer or not, they would receive one of these two items at the bottom. If they're not net metered, one of the other elements of our SNAP program is that the district would pay 75% of the market off-peak average price. So in 2015-2016, this was 1.53 cents per kilowatt hour produced. So those customers that do not receive the net meter benefit receive this payment instead. And then if they choose to be net metered, of course, that's at our 2.7 cent per kilowatt hour energy rate that's on the residential rate schedule. The one other difference here is the non-net metered customers, that compensation is on 100% of their generation. So that first meter in the schematic, when you're net metered, it's on the net of your use. So the second meter, the house meter. So the programs have been growing. This is the last 5 years, 2011 to current. 2016, of course, is a partial year, though we're almost there and we haven't had a whole lot of sunny days since I created this graph, so we should be pretty close. The blue is our net metered customers. That group has been growing. And red is SNAP. And then the schools are in green. So in general, our schools are technically net metered. However, they're directly connected to their system. They never produce more than they use. And so there's not a net meter on them. So it's just a little bit different how we monitor those. The purple line here is the capacity, so that's the kilowatt hours installed. So we have about, you know, between 350 and 400 kilowatt capacity, so that's the installed size of those solar panels. Then, you know, just for a comparison, our district as a whole, our system as a whole, our average load is about 200 megawatts. So it's very small compared to our total load, but that's good. We don't want to be talking about rates about, you know, when we have a huge amount of installed capacity where we might change things on people. We want to start talking about it now when things are small.
And Lindsay, I'm going to just take a pause here to ask Commissioner Congdon, what time frame, Commissioner Congdon, do you believe you still have before you need to drop the line?
No, I don't, but thank you. I need to drop off right now because the plane has just landed. So
okay. Could we...
I'll get back on at a little before 1.
Yeah, what I'd like to do is to move to the consent agenda, and go ahead and take a look at that while you're on the line, and then pick up where Lindsay is and the rest of our agenda this afternoon at 1 o'clock.
Okay.
Any objections to that?
No.
Okay. Commissioner Arsenault?
No, that's fine.
Okay. So is there a motion to accept the consent agenda as amended?
I move that we accept the consent agenda as amended.
I'll second the motion.
Okay. Any discussion? Hearing none, it's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda as presented. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion is carried.
And just, Commissioner, sorry, just for clarity, those include resolutions 9 and 10.
It does include pulling the minutes from December 12 and 13 and adding items 9 and 10.
Thank you.
So just for clarification. And so what I'm going to do is, if when Commissioner Condon drops off the line, we no longer have a quorum, which means we no longer have a meeting. So I hate to interrupt your presentation, but I'd like us to honor that and come back at 1 o'clock.
Okay.
Yeah, and if I could just say on behalf of staff, thank you, because best laid plans, I think the weather is creating some havoc here. And we see a lot of changes going on in real time. So having the business portion of the meeting covered at this point gives us some comfort that we'll be able to finish the year with all of the work done that we needed to get done.
Yep. It's nice to have the vouchers voted on. So, yes.
This is Ann.
Yes.
Yeah, I just want to echo that as well. Thank you so much,
right.
Everybody, for being flexible and accommodating me, trying to deal with weather.
Certainly. And we'll adjourn and reconvene at 1 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the afternoon session of Chelan County PUD. This is a regular commission meeting. Commissioners present are Commissioner Bowles and Arsenault, and on the phone is Commissioner Congdon. And we're going to take a little bit of a deviation in the agenda. We've already done the consent agenda this morning. And at this point, I'm going to call upon General Manager Steve Wright for a specific presentation.
Yeah, let me just lay out for benefit of the staff that's here the schedule for this afternoon so folks will know. We're going to do a presentation, then we're going to go back to Lindsay Mons to do the distributed generation discussion. We'll go to the customer information system update and then the public power benefit update. We'll do the lesson learned from the from resolution 10 and manager items and commission items. So back to a normal afternoon schedule then. With that, I want to ask Janet Jaspers if she would come up to introduce a special award.
Good morning. Today I would like to recognize one of our employees, Willard Fields, and maybe he could come up here with me. And so on November 21st, 2016, Willard completed 40 years of service with the district. He started as a two-year temporary employee to program a computer, and who would have known it takes a whole lot longer to program a computer. And so it's really looked for this job security year after year after year. So we've kept him around for, actually he retired for about 5 years and came back. So total 40 years and 5 months we've had him around. He's a great historian. So anything about the PUD or the history of the PUD, we go to Willard. He's the keeper of all things important. And so can say, oh, what's the capacity of Rock Island House Unit, you know, where you wouldn't know where to find the information. Willard has it either in his head or he has now a little quick sheet fact finder that he's now shared with a bunch of us. He really understands operations. He understands the marketing part and how they all fit together. He's just been a great mentor, teacher for a lot of us. I was hired in under Willard's group, and so I was great to work with him. And he's a really good problem solver. But there is a little bit of a negative. He does come up with, he's like an incorrect data finder. So every once in a while he comes up to me, Janet, I found this error in this report. Or Janet, I found this mistake. And I was like, okay, can you do this research and fix it? So every time he's done fixing something, he digs and finds another problem or incorrect piece of data. So I was kind of teased him last week that in 10 years we'll probably given him another 10-year pin, but he kind of had this. I'm not sure if it's going to happen, but he's just been great to work with, a great asset to the community. So thank you, Willard, for all of your service.
Yeah. I came here as a 2-year temporary employee to program the first computers at Rocky Reach, Rock Island, and replace the one in dispatch or system ops, because they was looking for an engineer that could do programming, and I had both degrees, electrical engineering and computer science, and a minor in fly fishing. I came from Montana State, Bozeman, Montana. But yeah, it was just 2-year, one of the first CSEs. It was Sonny Smart supervised it, for all of you that know Sonny Smart. And there was Ken Wilmuth and Bill Daring and myself. Bill Daring started out as a computer programmer here too, for those of you that know Bill Daring. But the three of us, we put in computer systems at the project and system ops. Anyway, I've moved around a lot within the district. I do have to say, the people you work with here are just super. They're great. They're smart. I mean, I'm just, sometimes I wonder, you know, sometimes it makes you feel that you're not very smart, because you just work around all these very smart people and great people to work with. I mean, they're just, all the different departments I work with, just super people.
So, Willard, I have a presentation that I want to make to you, but on a more informal basis. Every election cycle, I conduct a couple of classes for new commissioners coming into the state association. And to get the appropriate background and a clear line of sight, I've looked for a number of sources, and one of those sources is a document that was authored by you. And there are other people who have other memories of how the state association grew and what it became and who were the active participants in it. And I just want to say, it's really interesting that when you get other people's points of views, say, well, okay, you know, I'm not, you know, let me check into that. I get back. Well, what I do is I come back and I talk with Willard. that's where I check in. And I will say to the question and to the incident, it's that same fact-finding thing. What Willard has shared with me in writing and what he has shared with me in the verbal confirmation has always been 100% accurate. And so that tells me a lot about you, your involvement in this organization, your view of public power as a whole. And so your legacy it is much wider than Chelan County PUD. Every new commissioner educated in the state of Washington goes through a portion of the Willard legacy. And your recollection, your documentation, and your presentation of that information. So long after we can no longer present you with 40-year pins, the work that you've done will continue, because it's accurate, it's authentic. And it provides that, I think, that humble base of why we have public utility districts. So from the bottom of my heart, as a commissioner, as a historian, as a person who's had a chance in a leadership role in that state association, your contribution is a lifetime contribution and will continue to do so. So thank you very much.
Thank you. But I do have to say, I just continued on with what Wayne Wright did. I mean, Wayne Wright did a huge amount of documenting the history of the PUD, and I just continued on. But I took a lot of what I have is Wayne Wright's work.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because I've asked Wayne about that, and he said, well, yeah, I did some of that early work, but the person who's actually authenticated it and has given it its factual basis is Willard. So you're not getting off the hook, pal, but I think that says a lot about the organization and the two of you working together. But thank you. It's a service that will, like I say, continue. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
But that also tells me the humbleness of your nature. So with that being said, we have my honor to present someone a 40-year pin. I didn't know they made these, and it is just really a pleasure to be able to present you with this. And thank
you very much.
Say thanks for everything that you've done. Yeah.
And there's actually three of us that crossed over 40 this year.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Willard, I just have to chime in as a new commissioner. What Dennis said is true. Whether it was at Waputo or whether it was here at the district, as a new commissioner, anything that I wanted to learn that was historical, the answer I already knew. Go check with Willard. So thank you.
So the word Oracle has a meaning in terms of software, but it also has one in terms of, there's the Oracle of Omaha. Well, this is the Oracle of Schilling County PD. Thank you. With all that being said, Mr. Wright,
we want to invite Lindsay Mons to come back up and conclude her presentation from this.
Take the pause button off. And again, Lindsay, thanks for allowing us to interrupt your presentation and finish up a piece of business and then to come back.
No problem. I might have just lost Anne. She has a number to call back in.
Do we need to wait or should we?
Anne, are you there? Anne?
I think we just lost her.
Just lost her.
She had to make a transition someplace here, I think, and it's probably
not okay. Time. So, Anne, since this is not an item that we will be voting on, we can continue with two commissioners present as a general piece of information, for the commission and for the general public. So by continuing with two at this point, we're not in violation of our charter. So thank you.
Okay.
So I'd encourage you to go ahead.
Good afternoon. Lindsay Mons, business advisor for Customer Utilities. Back again discussing distributed generation, where we left off before the break. We were talking about our programs and their growth over the last few years here. And we have about 80 customers right now that are solar producers, distributed generation type customers in these classes. About half of those are net metered and the other half are split into the schools and the SNAP program. You see a big discrepancy here in 2015 between the capacity and the generation there. It's because one of our large net metered customers came online in December, so they didn't have hardly any production in 15, and it's 2016 is showing the true capacity and production relation there. So why we see our programs growing, some of the growth in influencers in the industry as a whole. Solar conditions are one, areas where there's a lot of sun, you see a lot of distributed generation. This is Arizona, Nevada, California, areas like that. Also areas with retail electric rates that make it more worthwhile. So high cost, Hawaii, it fits both the solar conditions and the high price retail rates. So those things influence growth in a distributed generation type system or customer base. Production incentives are another. The state production incentive here in Washington is set to sunset in 2020. So while we've seen quite a bit of growth in ours, largely driven by those production incentives, we expect it to kind of slow down now that sunset date's getting closer. Legislation can influence growth, of course, and technology and advancements. The picture you see down here on the slide is actually a roof made of solar panels. It's Tesla's invention of the solar panel tile for their roofing. There's several different varieties, but so advancements like that, you know, and as the cost comes down associated with that technology, you see increases in solar uptake, as well as customer opinion. I think here in Chelan County, we see a lot of growth associated with the customer opinion paired with production incentives. Our electric rates don't really incite solar growth. And while we do get a lot of sun, most of our load comes in the winter months, so the solar conditions and load don't line up. So those tend to not drive growth in our area. So as we went into this project, which was to define rates, so that was our 2016 target, was to establish a rate recommendation. We started looking around at what other utilities were doing. Really, we've been watching this for a while. It's quite interesting to see what others go through. But this is just a sampling of what's been in the news. And solar companies are trying all sorts of different things to address solar rates. Some you'll see on here are fixed charges. That's the customer portion of a bill. Some utilities are working through demand charges for residential. We don't have those types of things here. Well, number one, we don't have the metering for it. And second, it can be confusing to implement a demand rate on a residential. Other utilities are trying time of use rates. That's the TOU you see on the slide here. I think that covers most of them here. Anyway, so as we looked at, you know, what should we do as Chelan PUD, it became a little overwhelming at all the different options we had. So working with our steering committee, we decided to contract with Charlie Black of CJB Energy Economics. If Charlie's name sounds familiar, it's because we've worked with him before. He worked with the district on our IRP several years ago. So he's familiar with our operations and some of the things we do here. And we worked with him to research a distributed generation rate, common practices in the industry, particularly for people who look like us, you know, our winter peaking nature, our small customer base, our relatively low rates, things like that. We worked on current industry studies and opinions. So there's a lot out there, both academically and in the industry about where should we be going. And then analyzing our programs compared to others. So with Charlie, we came up with this list of what makes distributed generation an industry hot topic. It's talked about all over. I think every week there's new articles about distributed generation. The first item here is safety. As soon as you introduce bidirectional power flow into a typically single-directional system, you create safety risks. When there's outages, you could have power backflow into the system if those solar panels aren't correctly connected. So that's a big risk. The reliance on the utility for grid backup. In this area, when you have a solar production unit, you're utilizing some of that power for your own home needs. And if you have, say, snow on your tiles, or if suddenly your solar production unit just no longer works, you're reliant on the utility to provide 100% backup power. So it's not that we could change the size of our system because we have solar production. We always have to be ready to serve those customers. Many utilities in the South are seeing decreasing energy sales associated with the solar production, so they're not getting their full cost recovery that they need within their cost of service models. We see shifting cost recovery to the non-adopters. So as your group of solar adopted or adopters increases, the cost recovery becomes off balance, and some of those costs then are being recovered from the non-adopters. Some areas are seeing third-party service providers creating challenges. And then the last two here are actually benefits associated with solar production, and one's the ability to defer capacity or expansion projects. There's some utilities in New York utilizing this where they are able to slow down their system reinvestment and capacity growth because they're able to rely on their solar producers for some of that. And then the ability to decrease fossil fuel generation, that of course doesn't really apply to us, but many of those utilities who do rely on fossil fuel generation, they're seeing a benefit in the ability to decrease that that amount of use. So the common response to many of these is rates. So how you design your rates really depends on what your risks are. But here at Chelan PUD, Charlie's recommendation for us was to consider distributed generation impacts with a broader rate analysis and discussion, and not to single them out as a single customer class for rate analysis or rate decision. He did recommend we continue to address the issues early to limit that impact to customers, both our adopters and non-adopters, and to maintain awareness of industry developments. So as technologies change, or if we see our system growing, our number of customers with distributed generation, to be aware of that. And then finally, consider undertaking a value of solar analysis. So the value of solar analysis is a, I'm not sure where it originally came out of, but it considers more than just cost of service. It takes into account some of the softer costs associated with solar. Maybe it's environmental, maybe it's avoided generation, things like that. And really those are tailored to each utility and would, you know, be a discussion with the board all along the way as to what we'd want to include. But those were Charlie's recommendations for us. So as we move into the future, of course, ongoing, we're going to continue to monitor the legislation that goes through Olympia and what proposals are out there. And we'll monitor the production levels and growth within our programs. Looking forward to 2017 and 2018, if needed, we can review and confirm those 2014 distributed generation value statement and guiding principles that we talked about this morning in the first part of this presentation. We'll continue to utilize any technology that we have to gather information to better understand the DG operations and impacts. And consider that value of solar analysis. We'll do a little more research on that and talk with the board some more about whether that's the direction we want to go. And then integrate distributed generation with broader financial policy and rate guidance discussions, keeping in mind the interests of all customers.
I'd like to add to Lindsay's presentation for a second. Lindsay, if you'd go back to the last page for a moment. So recall that earlier this year we did a substantial amount of work on what we called long-term debt philosophy, and we looked at a whole bunch of scenarios that could impact the district's capital spend, ultimately borrowing and rates, and concluded from that we're in reasonably good shape. We don't think that we need to get into the bond market until probably 2021, 22, and pretty safe on the rate side under the expected value forecast, but there were scenarios in which things could get worse for us. Substantial decline in the market, cost increases, more regulatory requirements. So we said, well, we're going to at least do some work to put ourselves in a position so that if there was a need for a change in rates, that we'd be able to put some change in place in 2 to 3 year time frame. Not expecting that to happen, but just be prepared for the worst-case scenario. So we are building that into our performance plan for 2017. And if you'll note that the first two items here that Charlie Black recommended to us, the DG impacts, consider that as part of a broader rate analysis, that fits with that strategy to be able to look more broadly at what's the cost of service here, or some of that basic foundational work that gets done for rates. But I would also say there's a bit of an incongruity between that and the second recommendation, which is address issues early to limit impacts on customers, both adopters and non-adopters. Basically, what we're recommending here is you have to choose which way you're going to lean between those two objectives that Charlie identified. And we're leaning towards the let's integrate this more into an overall rates analysis and put ourselves in a position so that we can address DG as part of other changes that we may conclude after doing the foundational rates work we believe may be necessary for equity issues, cross-subsidy issues, those kinds of things that can come up when you're doing the basic foundational rates analysis. And we've come to that conclusion because of the graph that Lindsay showed earlier that says, well, even at this point, at 0.4 megawatts on our system out of a 200 average megawatt system, we really still have very low penetration in Chelan County compared to the problems that other utilities, those that list of utilities that she showed where people were taking action was because they had much greater penetration on their systems than what we've seen here. So we continue to put ourselves in a position to be able to move more quickly, building that foundation. But at this point, we're going to try to integrate it with some broader rates work. That's our recommendation, at least.
Steve, isn't that a self-fulfilling prophecy that as the electric rates that we charge go up, then distributed energy becomes more of a viable economic solution within the county? But outside of that, even our wholesale power sales into other markets outside of Washington State are affected by distributed generation.
Yeah, it can be. Although I would just say that with our rates being where they are relative to even the statewide average, the types of increases that we'd be talking about would be pretty modest and would still leave us way below the statewide average. So even in that scenario, things have gone way worse than our expected value. And we're needing to do something on the rate side, I still suspect that we would be among those that would be what would in the innovation curve would be described as the laggards, slower to have market penetration here than in other places.
Thank you.
That this future actions was my last slide, so if there's any other questions, okay. I'd be happy to take those.
Any questions or discussion from commissioners? Public? Lindsay, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. And thanks again for your flexibility.
I'd like to move next to the customer information system. We're really not at a decision point here, but we thought it would be worthwhile just to give you an update. We're in the middle of the request for proposal process. Sam Dilley is managing that process. Karen Wiggum has put some work into this. What we thought we'd do is just kind of give you an outline of the types of things that are likely to going to come up through the RFP process. And I want to highlight in particular that there's a fair amount of optionality here. So it's very difficult to predict at this point even what functions we'll be seeking to achieve, much less the ultimate cost. And so just kind of lay out the where we are in this process. Sam?
Good afternoon. My name is Sam Dilley. I'm a project manager here at headquarters.
I'm Karen Wiggum, staff attorney.
Today we're going to give a brief on just a brief update on the CIS information. A little bit of background first. The CIS project was initiated last year about this time. One of our first steps was to evaluate what we needed to do. So first thing was replace an existing CIS software with modern CIS software. Pretty straightforward. We anticipate the existing the new system to last for about 10 to 15 years. The existing system was installed around 2004, so we're looking at about 12 years. By the time we get that project done, we'll be approaching about 15 years on the existing system. The first thing we did was create a diverse team. We have IT people, we have conservation department, and of course we have customer utilities people who are using the software. In the first quarter of the year, we planned the project. We developed what we need to do and set a 2 to 3 year plan to develop the new CIS software. In mid-2016, with the project plan in place, the first thing we needed to do was develop the design requirements. So our team set about doing that in the second quarter. Throughout the summer and the second quarter, we worked pretty diligently with legal, I would say, developing the request for proposals, a fairly rigorous proposal, probably about 200 pages of contract requirements that we found, design requirements, that sort of thing. We were able to get that out on the street on September 23rd, and on December 2nd, we've received our proposals back from the public. Our core team is currently in the process of reviewing those proposals. You might want to question, what is a CIS and how does it affect the district? Customer information system is the software that is the database for all of our customers. So when our customers contact us, it's everything from starting a new service, changing a service, checking a bill, paying a bill, that sort of thing. It's everything customer facing for our utility. It's a pretty big database, and it's pretty important that we have a very viable one. Sometimes some of the things in it are called meter to cash, so metering turning into actually getting payments and getting that into the system. The other shaded item that you see there is batch scheduler. The batch scheduler is just exactly what it says. We don't want to be running a customer's bill as soon as we get a meter reading, that sort of thing. So we have a big system to batch it all up and run various billing reports, bill systems, those sorts of things. Those are our two key components to the customer information system. We don't feel that we'd be successful unless we had those as viable parts of the CIS. The other item that you see here, customer self-service, this is everything that we would like to be able to offer our customers online. So if a new customer came in, a new house, and they wanted to set up a service or they wanted to set up a temporary service to do the construction, they could go online and be able to fill out that sort of paperwork online or fill out those forms online. If they were changing locations or terminating, landlord wanted to keep a system live and had one tenant moving in, one tenant moving out, those sorts of things. So the customer self-service portal is a feature that we'd like to be able to add to the CIS. So we went out, we included that in our request for proposals, and we're getting pricing for that. Mobile work management is the call from a customer asking them to do something related to a work order, and how we would actually get that work order in the modern area and for the next 10 to 15 years, get that work order from coming in over the internet or coming in from a phone call and getting that out to the person in the field more effectively, more efficiently. We did include a couple things. I'll go over web chat just briefly. Web chat, that's the little box that you've probably seen pop up on the screen every once in a while and says, would you like to, you know, chat with a representative? And you can type in yes, and you can type in your question, and a representative comes back and types back to you and that sort of thing. We don't have that capability right now. We're not sure that we want that capability, but we wanted to be able to get pricing on it and see what's out there. Mm-hmm. When you start to think 10 to 15 years, that's a long time. And if that's the way that the market's migrating, we want to be able to look at that technology. Moving to the other side of the screen, a mobile app. That's an application for a phone, mobile phones. 2004 mobile phones were kind of getting into that data area, but our existing system isn't capable of doing that. So we wanted to have that capability if we wanted to have a mobile app system for our new customer software. Meter data management is a large database. When you look at, we were hearing earlier this morning, when you look at the data that's coming in nowadays, it becomes pretty staggering. We want to be able to do analytics, run reports, those sorts of things with our information. And as we move forward into the next decades, it's going to be very important that we have the ability to manage that data quickly, able to run reports and configure it in ways that show us kind of those aha moments that we're looking for in our data. And then finally, kiosk processing. Turns out that's actually a fairly challenging thing to do. You have something that takes some sort of remittance, and it's basically the customer self-service portal at a remote location, but it's a unique set of systems. So we wanted to be able to get pricing on that too, and so we're just looking for the information on that as far as optional pricing.
Sam, could you give me an example on that one, please?
Sure. If we decided that in South Wenatchee we wanted to have a payment system, a kiosk, we could set up a teller machine down there that would remotely allow people to walk up, type in their information to access their account, and provide remittance into the machine. And then we'd be able to see that that was done, and that would come into our system just as if they were at our counter.
All right. Thank you.
I'm going to turn it over to Karen to talk a little bit about the RFP process.
Thank you, Commissioners. I'm here to talk about the competitive negotiation statute, which came into existence about 20 years ago, 1996. the legislature recognized that there was a difference between the bidding process and what was acquired through the bidding process, which is typically a consistent product, a widget for a machine, equipment for dams, that type of thing. But with electronic data processing, they recognized that these were multifaceted products that may not always be alike. And for that reason, they adopted an alternative process that can be used. It's alternative to the bid. It still has the requirements of a bid in that you have to put out notice, you have to publish in the newspaper for at least 13 days. And it includes the acquisition of software, hardware, firmware, software services, software as services, which means that the software could actually be hosted at a different facility than here at the district, and covers telecommunications, equipment, and services. It provides the district and other municipalities in the state a flexible mechanism for acquisition of these products, and that's what we're using for the customer information system. And I would say I came here in 2000, and we did, I think, the first RFP here in that year. RiskMaster was that RFP, and now we're on again to customer information system. So what does it require? First of all, it requires a fair and unbiased system, and that's what the bid statute does. In and of itself, it provides a fair and unbiased system. The thing that is different with this is that the district gets to set the process. It has to be an evaluation process with factors that are relevant to the products that are being purchased. There is one requirement under the statute for the factor of cost, although for competitive negotiation, you don't have to take the lowest cost as you do in a bid process. In a bid, you take the lowest cost.
So why is that, Karen?
Under the, I think it goes along with the recognition that these products are different, mm-hmm. In the sense that the factors that are assessed, some of those factors may be more important than cost. For example, one of the first things that we look at is a vendor profile. One of the things that has been very important to the commission in the past is the financial situation of vendors, especially vendors who will support products over a long period of time. In this case, we're looking at a 10 to 15 year horizon, and we would want companies that would be with us for that period of time, if possible. Mm-hmm. And so it may be that that factor is given higher importance. There are other pieces. How well have they done their jobs in the past? In this situation, we'll be looking at other builds that they have done to make sure that they've been successful and how long they've lasted. So those factors are really important for us as well.
So what I'm hearing then is that mitigation can be a perhaps a greater factor than lowest cost.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
Risk mitigation.
And in some cases, cost can be the final number on these RFPs. If you are doing a purchase simply for software and you're just getting licenses from a number of different resellers, then the bottom line there is that the lowest cost would be the largest factor.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I think to go back to Sam's graph, too, standardization is not the way we do things here. So we're looking at a variety of different options, and you're trying to package them up and say, what's the value created from the different packages that people will propose?
Yeah, and part of the question is, if I'm sitting listening to this presentation and, you know, there's been kind of a standard response to low-cost bidding, and I'm sitting listening to this presentation to understand why there's an allowance to move away from low-cost is an important piece for, I think our ratepayers to understand that variability.
Totally understand that and want to reassure the ratepayers that we are looking at cost. And we look at it in the sense of, at least in this project, we have a couple of phases, and we look at cost in both of those phases. And that's a good segue into looking at the CIS proposal specifically and the evaluation factors that we're looking at. So I'll turn it over to Sam at this point.
I would also say that in a bid process, a construction bid process, a concrete beam is a concrete beam. And we specify the size of the steel, the amount of the steel, how far the steel will be embedded in the concrete, the amount of concrete, that sort of thing, the strength of the concrete. Software projects such as this, where it's competitive and based on some other things other than just pricing, have differences. You can't always say that the software will be created exactly how and why. And so there's a little bit more different. It's a different different type of analysis.
That comes with the name soft.
Yeah. Talking about the evaluation process that we have for these proposals, as Karen got into a little bit, the vendor profile, we want to make sure that they're a firm that has quite a bit of industry expertise. They've been around for a while. We're going to start looking at the references in this section, knowing that their financials are very important to us. So we've requested that information, and this is the point where we look at it. I mentioned the project team, the functional matrix, is the design requirements. I mentioned that the project team worked through the first and part of the second quarter coming up with design requirements. There's some 3,800 questions that we've answered and worked on to define how we want the software to work and what we want it to do for our utility. At this point, we're asking the proposers to respond to those 3,800 questions and see what they can do, see which elements they're able to provide us, that sort of thing. So this is where we get into the really intensive analysis of the software. The technical solution is how it functions for us. You can imagine that you can design something that meets the specifications, but if it's clunky or if it's not efficient to use or that sort of thing, the technical solution are the screens and the manner with which they provide the software. Implementation strategy, plan and strategy, that is the process for how they implement the project here at the utility. Will they be good to work with? Are they used to working with a utility of our size and our project team with our capacity? Are they very large or are they much smaller than us? Solution costs, as we mentioned, that's very important for us, and we'll be evaluating that as well. And then later on, we'll be looking at kind of their innovation and flexibility. When they come on site, we'll be doing interviews. This is a fundamental part of the interview process is who are they and how do they work and collaborate. They'll also be, during the interview process, doing demonstrations. We expect to be doing approximately 2.5-day interviews with each potential software provider. And then again, we'll be doing rigorous reference checks. We may be looking at some of the past locations where they've installed the software and also checking them at their corporate locations.
And maybe I missed it, but one of the things that, you know, in looking at this, and I like this chart, we have a lot of other software programs in the district running in a lot of different areas. Where do we measure the interface capabilities of what it is we're looking to adopt?
Sure. In the implementation process, there's testing, and it's an iterative process. We go through testing, we learned what we didn't, what the software wasn't successful doing, and then we go back and we do evaluation, retest, testing and retesting of it, that sort of thing. Related to the other software processes, our IT department has a number of platforms that we operate, Oracle being one of them. So the IT department will be working with that, with the vendor at that point, making sure that they integrate cohesively, coherently.
Okay, through the platform level.
Yes.
So when people ask what a RFP is in the competitive negotiation process, this will give you a good idea of what the core team is doing right now. We've received a significant number of proposals, and each member of the team is having to go through each one and review it and evaluate it. And so there's a lot of hard work that's going on right now. And that's a lead into the next steps. And right now we're in the process, which is phase one, where we've received the written proposals last on December 2nd. And the team is currently reviewing those before Christmas. Merry Christmas, everybody. and at the end of phase one, we anticipate a selection of shortlisted proposers. After we select the shortlist, those would be the proposers that will come on site and provide demonstrations to us during phase two, after which we will review and evaluate and select apparent successful proposers. And what that means is we send them a notice and say, you know, we think that you are the best proposer. Hello?
Hello, this is Ann.
Hi, yeah. Ann. This is Karen Wiggum. We're right in the middle of the CIS, so we'll carry on, and if you have any questions, we can answer them.
Thank you.
So, phase two, on-site product demonstrations, evaluation, selection of apparent successful proposers. We will, after that, start negotiating contracts with them, and we're hopeful that we would have a contract in place by the end of summer 2017, and then we would have implementation starting, if everything goes well, in late summer of 2017. And we also anticipate that the time span for implementation of the project would be about 2 years. So we'll be looking at late summer of 2019 in order to finish it. And with that, if you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
I'm just curious, slide 8, which is stacks of notebooks.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And there's 10 stacks.
I think there was 11 stacks. 11.
That's why we have engineers, we have commissioners. Some can count to 10, some can go to 11. What am I looking at there?
So each notebook represents a proposal that we've received. We have 11 team members, or 11 different sets of notebooks. We have approximately 8 team members reading each of those notebooks, one of the team members. And so I've been diligently reading those. We'll be scoring those in early January and looking to make our list of people that we want to go forward with and do interviews with.
Okay. So you also understand now why I do not have a background in engineering. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
That helps. That really does. I was looking at that going, well, I'm not quite sure what I'm looking at, but thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, too. Thanks.
Okay. Recall that last meeting we had a discussion of the public power benefit and closing out 2015 and 2016, and you asked us to give some more thought to part the question of the option of thinking about creating a reserve account next year that could encompass this thought or may not, depending on how the board wants to go. And so we've done a little bit of work on that, and Kelly Boyd and Micah will be presenting for us today.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah, and for the formal record, I'm Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer, and joining me is Micah Linderman, Senior Analyst here at the district. And Steve gave the recap of the things we've done in the past few meetings, and then having a couple more weeks for questions and answers and further thinking time, circling back to options that we can consider for closing out the funding for the 2015 to 2016 period are to just consider it complete as is. And what that means is just we close out the year as it is. There is funding set aside for the projects that have been identified and are active. So it doesn't have any impact on the ongoing projects that are still working towards completion. It's only considering the amount that was never assigned to just be closed as is. Each year, though, how we have contemplated the program is that there is a decision process each year. And so for 2017, there's already some projects that are lined out to be done. And then there's pool from the 2017 or funds from the 2017 pool that are also available. So still more decision making each year to be done for projects that maybe have are still on the list but haven't been assigned any funding. So that's one option. Another option would be to allocate additional amounts out of the unassigned amount and assign to new or existing projects. Another option would be to consider allocating the unassigned funds to a long-term facilities fund, which this is an option that was part of the discussion from the last meeting. And we talked about it a little bit, but this can be done, this option can be done, and it's part of our core work. So it can be done as part of our normal course of work outside of the public power benefit program. And because of that discussion from the last meeting, we've added this fourth option that you see here. And that option would be that we could establish an action item for us to look at other ways to create internal reserves for things like long-term facilities needs and other items that may require reserves. And take that on as an action item to look into that further, give some further description of pluses and minuses and how that might work, and then report back to the board with that in the February timeframe. Maybe even as part of our Q4 financial update, we do a special topic each quarter, and that's an idea maybe for our special topic for the Q4 report. But we can put more information around what that what setting up those internal reserves may look like. And again, that we can do that as part of our core work and our core funding outside of the public power benefit. It wouldn't change anything with that. And there may be other ideas. So that's just a recap of the options. So probably just open it for further discussion.
Let me add one thing if I could. I think based on the previous conversation with the board, our staff recommendation would be a combination of option one and option four, that we would leave the funding as is, count the $5.2 million as done, and then move on. But we would be, we're prepared to work on creating some thoughts around the development of an internal reserve option for things like long-term facilities. If we are to go down that path of combining option one and four, we think that that is consistent with the way the strategic plan was drafted, which spoke to no carryovers of funds, and that it would not require a resolution on the part of the board to do that. So we're really, that's why the words at the bottom say requesting board guidance, just to say this is the path that we think we've heard from you that you're interested in, the path that we're planning to go down, but we want to check in and make sure that we haven't misread the conversation from the last meeting.
So, commissioners, your thoughts, desires, input?
Well, I, as one commissioner, am in favor of item number four, which would establish action items to look at other ways to create internal reserve for things such as long-term facilities needs. It creates a broad set of bookends in my mind, and it addresses the issue of future unallocated, or I should say unassigned dollars for the public power benefit program, as opposed to having that money in item number one where it would cease. It creates unallocated dollars that I guess I don't condone use it or lose it spending, and I'm just concerned that number one might promote a use it or lose it spending philosophy that I'm against philosophically. So I personally would be in favor of number four.
Commissioner Congdon, do you have any thoughts, input you'd like to give at this time?
No, I'm fine. Thank you, Dennis.
Okay. Looking at these, I understand the need to do a considered complete, close it out, but also to have some institutional memory of those dollars without committing those dollars to a specific earmarked account, because you can paint yourself into a corner. And so I really like the combination of one and four, and would just simply encourage moving forward along those lines. And those are my thoughts. And part of it is, I guess, for also, if we're looking at, I think we're probably going to go back to looking at working at the federal level to get early credit. Mm-hmm. And it kind of holds it open that some of the projects that we might not be able to get early credit for now maybe have an opportunity for new life later as early credit might actually, if Congress functioned and we had that opportunity, would preserve at least the opportunity to go back and explore some of those and see where we could get a benefit for the public as well as for some long-term credit.
And I do think that would be consistent with that annual decision making, where you could look at your what you can afford at that point in time by looking back and looking forward and looking at the projects before you, including any previous ones that now may be their time instead of when they were originally proposed. So I do think that all of that would still fit into that annual decision making of mm-hmm. the program.
Yeah, and without going to a motion or without going to a vote, because I think that's too formal at this point, do we have enough of a head nod? Does the staff have enough of a head nod to go forward and come back with a recommendation in the future?
I think we do, because fundamentally, as long as we know that the board is interested in this option four and developing the concepts around reserve fund, we can bring that back to you. And how the board chooses to allocate dollars to a reserve fund is completely within the domain of the board to consider. So that could include a consideration of the 2015-16 yeah. spend. It could look at how we did in 2016. And go further back than that. There are a lot of different options there that we can consider. And I think that's one of the reasons that we find that attractive, is because it keeps your options open for how you want to handle that.
Yeah, I just don't have any desire to tie people's hands with a motion that's early in the process, but provide a direction so that we can look toward what model might fit things as most appropriate as we could.
And we are still rather early in the program, and we are learning a lot about the best way to manage it. So I think this goes right along with that.
Yeah, and I think it's still, it's worth noting that we're probably the only public utility in the United States having this consideration. Mm-hmm. And what a privilege it is to be in that spot. So thanks to everyone. So you okay?
Yep, thank you.
All right, good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we'll continue on with the agenda, and I believe we're at flipping the page, manager items.
Actually, we're going to do one quick thing. We had the lessons learned from resolution number 10. Although the resolution has already been approved, I think the lessons learned is worth spending a moment on.
So yeah. Well, we can make that a manager item.
Ian Adams to join us to talk about that.
All right. Good afternoon. As Steve mentioned, my name is Ian Adams. I'm the Hatchery Maintenance and Operations Coordinator for the district. Thank you for the opportunity to present this lessons learned. In June of 2013, the district entered into a contract with Pump Tech out of Bellevue, Washington, to provide repair service for Flowserve, Pfluger, and Byron Jackson pumps and motors located throughout the district. One of the goals of the contract was to replace mercury-sealed pumps and motors, or actually retrofit pumps and motors with mercury seals with mechanical seals. And during this process, the contractor was removing a motor and a pump from a well, got it to the surface, separated the pump and motor, and unbeknownst to the contractor, the seal, mercury seal, had ruptured. So the contractor had a small spill of mercury, largely ended up on the back of his truck, a little bit on the ground. The district was quick to respond. We contacted the district's environmental compliance tech, and he arrived on site in a short time and was able to provide the district staff and the contractor with the appropriate tools and equipment to mitigate for the spill. Essentially a specific type of vacuum cleaner that was able to vacuum up this mercury and contain it. Lessons learned in this process were anytime the district is going to enter into a contract with a contractor that is going to have a potential exposure to a hazardous material this magnitude, that a more thorough audit of the safety procedures, response procedures, and cleanup containment procedures should be conducted before work begins. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Jerry?
No.
No.
No. Thank you.
No, I just think that we've improved our concept of what to do with certain materials such as mercury. You know, as a child, we thought it was a good toy. But thank goodness we've become a little more educated and moved on. But thank you for the report and the lessons learned. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We do have a couple of manager items. First of all, I'm going to ask Mario Pantu to come up and speak to a recent event that was held. And Lorna Klemanski will join him.
Good afternoon, Lorna Klemanski, Managing Director of Human Resources and Safety. And I just would like to introduce Mario Cantu. He's the Education and Community Engagement Coordinator. That's a new position that was created through a convergence of two district outreach efforts. External Affairs and Communications started a couple of years ago, reaching out to the Hispanic, Latino, and low-income communities. And we heard from the diverse leaders group that was created through that and through the customer satisfaction survey that our Hispanic Latino community would like to be engaged with us in more and in various ways. Meanwhile, another need was when we received direction through the stakeholder or the strategic engagement process. And so we wanted some public power benefit to be used to provide more engagement and education efforts. So created Mario's position. He was selected through a competitive recruitment process and he's had a lot of ideas and has been consulting on our communications and developing education engagement efforts. And the first major event he planned and coordinated was last night, and I'll let him tell you more about it.
Good afternoon, everyone. Mario Cantu again, Education and Community Engagement Coordinator, Chelan County PUD. Quite a mouthful. Happy to be here. This is my seventh week, I believe. So we have enjoyed our time at the district. Great collaboration, great support system, great mentorship from everyone in the team. And happy to give you a quick overview about the event that we hosted last night. The event's called Fiesta Decembrina, and really what it stands for is just a December holiday party. The concept really came about a partnership with a radio station, a Spanish radio station called La Nueva, as part of the Alpha Media Group. La Nueva has been doing these events for 14 years, and it's a series of events that starts on December 12th, worked the way up to the 24th, as a way to count down for the holidays, if you would. So we had an opportunity to partner up with them, and we thought, well, let's go ahead and build back on some of the customer satisfaction survey. Thank you, Lorna. And see how we can line that up. It wasn't a fiesta just to create a fiesta, but it was a way to engage with our Hispanic Latino community and a way also to gather up some data. So we got together with a few other departments. We had resource tables. We had activities, games. There's a team right there. You might notice there's a guy missing. That would be me. And I guess I was too busy taking the picture on that one. But a great team. Folks were out here from Rock Ridge, Parks. We had, who else did we have there? We had HR. Anyway, the list goes on. So what we've done is we created this little flyers here. We call them passports. And the objective of this was to be very intentional and to have folks engage with the different resource tables. As you can see, there was a total of, what do we got here? Eight tables. Folks were encouraged to visit with each resource table and find something new about that they did not know about the PUD. Now, on the back of that, it's a quick little survey. It's six questions and a place for comments, where we learn a little more about how our Hispanic Latino customer owners would like to be engaged with the PUD. So we asked, what all services do you know about the PUD? And we provided a list. How do you currently access the information and services at the PUD? And how would you like to hear from us? I think we're facing a time frame where our communications have changed a little bit, and we have to be willing to modify and adjust to that. So we're willing to make that compromise. And lastly, we asked some questions for some statistics internally. So we self-identify Hispanic, Latino, yes, no. We didn't want to just assume that because you showed up to the event. So anyway, we have now created a solid foundation of database that would allow us to move forward with a comprehensive plan based on what our customer owners decided to do based on the survey. So the event was a great success. We had a bunch of people showed up. Lorna there has a bucket where we collected all the different passports. So we initially printed 120 of them. We quickly ran out, so we had to go back for seconds. We had folks fill them all in. It's really nice to go back and see folks fill them out all the way, including some email addresses, which is part of the result of the survey. And we have email addresses, phone numbers. We had folks from Aniat, Peshastin, Kashmir, Wenatchee, all over the county. Over the two-hour event, we had between 250 and 280 people show up.
Wow,
that's great. So it really went well. There's no way this could have been done without the help of all the different teams who participated in collaboration from the folks in the district. So I think in a nutshell, that's it.
Nice.
Unless you guys have any questions.
Nice start. When I looked at the photograph of the crew, you couldn't have done better. That's
thank you.
It's quite a group.
Yeah.
Excited to be here.
Yeah. Maureen, may I ask a little bit about your background, how you got to this position at Chelan County PUD? And
sure.
Just so we know a little bit more about you, just in a
okay
family
yeah.
sense.
You bet. So I have been working with different organizations over the last 45 years, trying to do very similar efforts. How do we engage with groups that we have not been so successful at? And really, there's no magic pill for that. However, I believe we're more effective if we start, I call it working backwards, where we go out to the public and we find out from folks how they want to be communicated to and how you want to be engaged, what's valuable for you, so we can bring you back and develop a framework that aligns well with that. So really busy supporting a lot of grassroots initiatives over the last several years, working very closely with a lot of different partners in the county. And I think it really truly takes a village. So it's working through those collaborations and through those partners that will get this accomplished. So.
Well, welcome, and we're happy to have you a part of the team.
Excellent.
Thanks for your time. It's been due for a long time, and it's just delightful for it to be off the ground and going. And thank you very much to everyone who's made this possible.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Oh, good. Next up, we just want to do the annual reminder about how we'll be handling Martin Luther King Day here. Carrie Wendell will make a presentation for us. Sorry, Carrie. I know that we've been at.
That's all right.
She's probably a little out of breath here.
I just wanted to let you know that we're planning for to close the main office lobbies to customers and phones on Martin Luther King Day. We'll also be closing the Leavenworth and Chelan offices. We're planning to work on some internal, external customer service training with all of the customer-facing groups. So it'll involve about 30 participants with Michael Nash. So we're looking forward to that. And then we'll be working with communications, switchboard, and tech shop, and the village to try to cover the offices. We'll get lobby signs up, and just it'll be a good day of training. So that's our plan.
And you've been doing this for a number of years now, right?
Yes, we've done it. This will be our fourth year. So.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Okay. Carrie, specifically to you and your crew, it's always interesting. And for our communications people as well, a few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to interview for the first time with Michael Knight at KPQ. And it was an interesting introduction when I walked through the door, and then off we went into the interview on the radio. But during his introduction to me, he made several comments. First of all, as a new person to the community, coming into our lobby, making contact with our people at the windows and getting signed up and that kind of thing was a very positive experience for him. So this is a three-point compliment. Secondly, he said the most overwhelming thing was later a handwritten follow-up thank you note. He said, I just didn't realize people did that anymore. And he said, I have saved that because my wife has yet to move to the community. But he said, I want to share that with her as a demonstration of what kind of a community this is. And then he said the third thing, and he said, very, very important, is I got my first bill and thought it was wrong and called for clarification only to find out it was right. So he said, when I look at the personalization at the counter, the note, and then the quality of service and the price, he said, this is a totally impressive thing, which really made it easy for me to start an interview with him. But thank you, you know, to you and your staff. And obviously it was a great impression on a new customer and one who will voice opinion about Chelan County PUD. So I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. I have a great group, so they get all the credit.
Yeah, well, thank you. Leadership helps.
I think that's it for us for manager items for today.
Okay.
So we're ready to move on to commission items.
And I think Ann has dropped off. Yeah. So Mr. Harris, is there anything you want to add?
I don't think so.
No? Okay. I think I'm good too.
The only commissioner item I would like to add is Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
So we had a couple of follow-up items. First of all, you'd asked for update on utility-focused education programs. We're scheduling that for the board meeting in February, so you'll be seeing that come back in the early part of next year. There was a request to look at a tour of our facilities for the commissioners, and because it would be the commissioners, it would be an open public meeting as well, and so we have tentatively scheduled that for January 9th. For those of the public who want to follow along, we will not be providing transportation. It'll have to be, so here's where we'll be at different points of time, and then letting them know when and where to show up. Finally, there was the follow-up on reserve funding and connection potentially to facilities planning, and you heard that one earlier today. Okay.
Delegation of action items?
I actually do not have any for today. Unless I missed something.
Okay. A comment, and again, follow up. You know, we had the what I call the pigeon article in the paper, and it's always interesting how people view things. And so, I got the proverbial question, buttonholed question in terms of why are you killing pigeons? My response was, I don't know if to the person, I don't know if you thought about it, but in this case, these are just rats with feathers. What would you have us do? And so that made sense because they'd had a pack rat in their garage and had exterminated the rat because they didn't want to deal with the droppings. And so that was a necessary connection. But anyway, it's just interesting where we attract attention. But we have to continue doing what we need to do to protect the safety and health of our workers. It's appreciated. Anything else? Any other items before the commission?
Don't have any today. We do have a very short executive session item. I would expect we would be done in 15 minutes.
15 minutes. Okay. So we need to take a break, or do we hold public comment? Oh, so additional public comment, additional items? Hearing any, then I will adjourn into executive session to discuss legal counsel and agency enforcement actions, litigation or potential litigation to which the district or its board is likely to become a party, and a legal risk as authorized by RCW 4230-1101I for approximately 15 minutes. So we will be out of executive session somewhere around 2:35. This is Chelan County Board of Commissioners, December 19th, coming back into our regular session. The time is 2:32, and coming out of executive session, no decisions were made, no votes taken. Any other items to come before the commission? Hearing none, our meeting is adjourned. Thank you.